The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we have a special treat for you on the program this morning. My guest in studio is Chris Tappitz. Hello, Chris. Welcome back to Yellow Springs.
Thank you. It's good to be here at WISO and here in YS.
Chris, you grew up here, right?
I did. I was born and raised here, with the exception of about a year that I don't remember way back when. But I came all the way up through the Yellow Springs school system, and I'm a Yellow Springer.
And you're back in town because you still have family here, and as we're recording this, you're just now wrapping up a week at the Antioch Writers Workshop where you've been on the faculty. What has that been like for you?
It's been a much it's a much bigger experience than I've expected it to be, which is to say I'm teaching the young writers track, a group of 15 to 18-year-old writers, and I do some teaching. I don't do a lot of teaching, but I did not expect them to be such an amazing group of motivated, fantastic writers who really just want to do their best work and create great stories. And that's what they've been doing.
And what does that involve as far as teaching them? I'm sure most of our listeners have never been to a writer's workshop. What is that all about? What do you do?
When I was told I'd be teaching the young writers, I thought, okay, I need a workshop for young writers. But then again, this is a group of kids who want to spend a week of their summer vacation sitting inside and writing. They're highly motivated, as I said before. So once I got a look at their work, really what I needed to do was create a workshop for writers, just writers, period, of any kind. And that means looking at elements of craft, character, setting, plot, conflict, all the basics that go into story, and ways of taking where they are with those elements and trying to elevate their ability to integrate them into story. And also talking about things like, you know, core material and truth, and what is it that you personally bring to a story that you can integrate in there as well.
Chris Tappitz joins us, and Chris is teaching at the Antioch Writers Workshop, and it's an area that he's quite familiar with. You've written quite a few books, and you write for younger readers. Tell us about yourself, about your career trajectory so far.
I come from a theater and film background. I was a big theater geek in high school. And I majored in film at Northwestern University way back in the day, all of which set me on a trajectory towards some form of storytelling for a living. When I look back on all the things I always liked to do, it was about reading books and writing stories and putting on plays and going to the theater, making movies, going to the movies, even watching way too much TV when I was a kid. All of it. It's all storytelling. And what happened, what I discovered along the way in a sort of passive way was the thing, I loved doing all of those things. And the one where I was willing to do the full package, which is to say the art of the art and the business of the art, was writing and publishing. And within that, once I started taking a few classes about writing for kids, that was really where I settled into my wheelhouse. That's where I found myself motivated to submit my work, take the kind of rejection that you have to go through to eventually get published. And I've been writing for kids ever since.
Would you say that your demographic, that your usual audience, is what we would describe as middle schoolers?
I write what I call middle grade fiction, and everybody has their own slightly varying definitions of that. And I say that's generally for an 8 to 12-year-old audience. I also write what I call young adult fiction, which is maybe 12 and up. And within those categories, there's young adult, there's older old young adult. I have one young adult novel that's pretty squeaky clean. And another young adult novel I just sold in April that I'm working on now that's a little less squeaky clean.
Chris Tappitz joins us. You have been doing this for a while, and you've, over the last few years, gotten yourself into a very lovely situation, I would suppose. You're collaborating with a writer that some of our listeners have probably heard of. Do you want to tell us about this?
Yeah, a big part of my professional life right now is doing co-authoring with James Patterson. He is known in some circles for his adult mysteries, but about 2009, 2010, as his own son was becoming a reluctant reader, he got motivated to start thinking about the idea of children's books. And Jim went looking for co-authors, as he works with a lot of co-authors on his adult books as well. And he went looking for co-authors on his children's books. And we found each other through a book packager. Should I explain what that is?
Sure.
As well? My very first novels were written with a company called Alloy Entertainment, and they're a book packager, among other things. And what book packagers do is they develop ideas for books or series books, and then they find writers who want to write that idea and sell the whole package to a publisher. In this case, it was Penguin Puffin. And so they're a clearinghouse for ideas as well as authors, which makes it a good place to go for someone like Jim who's looking for co-authors. He brought me on board for this middle school series, and we've been working together ever since. I've always said that I think my theater and film background made me a good pick for this kind of work. I don't think every author is suited to co-authoring. Some people really, really need to write their own ideas and really need to focus singularly on that. I come from a collaborative storytelling background that I think makes this just right for me.
What was that like? What was the process like? Did you meet him in person and then go from there? How did you approach this?
The managing editor at that book packager asked me to write a couple of sample chapters based on an idea from Jim, and I did that. And then the next step was to come to New York for a meeting where I thought I'd be interviewed further. But in fact, it was just a meeting to be told, okay, here's what we're going to be doing. So somewhere in there, I got the job without quite being told. Made the interview a lot less stressful than I thought it was going to be. He's a very nice guy. He's an imposing guy. He's a 2,000-pound gorilla in the publishing industry. And he knows his place, but he's also a very mellow guy. It's an interesting dichotomy within somebody as successful as that.
I've met him a couple times. I'm sure he wouldn't remember me, but he's a hardworking guy. Both times he was at book expos and he was in the booth at his publisher and he was signing. And you would think a guy like him with his profile would just be comfortable staying home and not bothering with all that. But man, he was just right out there in the thick of it.
It's always been an interesting question before I ever worked for Jim. You know, what kept Martha Stewart going to work? What keeps Oprah going to work? What keeps those? It's because they love what they're doing. And, as he said the other day, why write another book? Why have another piece of chocolate? It's just something he loves to do.
And when you put these books together, how many is it now? Five that you've done together?
Counting the two that are coming out in October, I'm not entirely sure. I think we've done about eight.
Eight now?
Yeah.
What's the process like as far as that goes? Does he give you the story idea and you take it from there each time?
I've done a lot of co-authoring. It's a weird kind of – not a weird niche, but it's weird that I've fallen into it by coincidence in so many different ways. I've worked with three different folks and it's been different every time. Primarily, though, my co-authoring has been with Jim. And the ideas, the characters come from him. He's got way more ideas than he'd ever be able to write on his own. So he comes up with basically an outline, a chapter-by-chapter detailed outline. He passes that on to me. If he feels like it's ready to go, he asks me to jump in and start first drafting that story. If he thinks it could be expanded, he asks me to rewrite the outline a little bit. And then depending on the length of the contract, I send in a chunk once a month for 5, 6, 10 months, depending on the book. And we'll talk about how the story's going, what needs to be developed, what maybe we need to pull out. And again, he's been very creatively generous. His instruction is usually, if you see something that doesn't work, go ahead and change it.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't like that, then we change it again. It's a dynamic process, but it all ends with him. He takes that finished draft of the story and he rewrites it to completion. And then in the case of the books I've been working on, those then go on to an illustrator who the conceit of this series we work on is that our main character is an artist and the sketches all throughout the book are the character sketches. So we have an illustrator for that as well.
And this is the middle school series, and you've got titles in it like The Worst Years of My Life, Get Me Out of Here, How I Survived Bullies, Broccoli, and Snake Hill.
They're high drama years, yeah.
Just My Rotten Luck, Save Rafe. These books are good sellers, aren't they?
Yeah, the series has done really well. I think it speaks to a lot of the experiences that middle schoolers have on a day-to-day basis. A couple of the things I picked up along the way in talking to middle schoolers and visiting schools is it's been a long time since I was in middle school, so I wanted to get a feel for what it means to be in middle school today. And what I learned was the props have changed, the technology has changed, but being a sixth grader is the same now as it was back then in terms of emotionally, developmentally. So I learned a lot from these kids, but I also could draw on my own experience.
Chris Tabitz joins us in studio. He's back in Yellow Springs at the Antioch Writers Workshop and visiting family here in Yellow Springs where he grew up. I think of being a sixth grader, and I remember it very well. I think it's the same, but it's also very different, at least in my sense, trying to connect with what that sixth grader must be feeling right now today. On the morning after, as we record this, another horrible incident in Nice, mm-hmm. France, at Bastille Day fireworks celebration yesterday. We won't get into the details. I'm sure our listeners are aware of them. Being a kid in these days, in these times, does this influence the way that you write, trying to talk to these kids in stories?
I think you're right that it of course, has to influence the way kids are perceiving the world around them. And I remember walking through a couple of elementary schools and seeing pictures on the wall. There was one elementary school in particular where they were asked to draw a picture of and write a little story about their wishes for the world. And I saw things about poverty and HIV and AIDS and war and things that I'm not sure that would have come to mind for me for my wishes for the world when I was back that age. So there's definitely a layer that that I don't remember anyway. I don't remember taking on. But in terms of the writing process, one of the things these books do that I think have surprised some readers and some critics is they do take on some heavy issues, but those heavy issues are more personal and a little more timeless in terms of family dynamics, what it means to be bullied. Bullying is a big theme in these books. And and while bullying has come into the forefront as a more discussed topic in a great way for kids these days, I don't know that it's necessarily a new thing. Certainly it's not.
Well, I think we've always had bullies. Sometimes they run for the highest political offices. I don't think it's unusual to have bullies around us, but you're right. They are getting a lot more attention.
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing. There are sometimes the question becomes, you know, is this a phenomenon that's on the rise or is it just the awareness that's on the rise? And I'm not even sure that the answer is important. I'm just glad for the increased awareness around it. Bullying is a really tough topic. I mean, you can talk about it all you want. And even in the form of story, how do you create a story that's not trite in terms of having a character deal with a bully? If you want to be a responsible author, the answer certainly isn't violence, but the answer also isn't to create a pat, you know, just stand up for yourself kind of narrative. So narratively, that's one of the trickier topics for me, but it's one I'm glad to take on.
When I think about grade school, I wasn't particularly concerned about bullies, but it seemed like the fear that we had was more of a monolithic fear. I know I'm older than you are. We were more concerned about going through our drills and crawling under the desk so we could prepare for the nuclear attack. It was something ominous but not specific.
Our version, I suppose, would have been the tornado drills that we had growing up here in Yellow Springs. But honestly, I mean, it's interesting that you're bringing all this up. You're making me think and you're making me reflect back because my initial research experience was all about how it's still just the same to be in sixth grade as it was back then. But it is. It's a scarier world, and I'm going to have to think about that some more.
So you were probably in school with the recent memory of the Xenia tornado, so I imagine that was probably a very strong factor here in Yellow Springs.
Oh, yeah. I remember that day very well. I must have been, I guess it was 1974, was it? 73? I was 9 or 10 years old. And like a lot of people, it's funny, you pick a symbol and sometimes that your memory latches onto. And I remember those tennis ball sized hailstones that were coming down, the ones that a lot of us kept in our freezer for years after
that. Did you?
Yeah.
That same day as the tornado, you had hail that big?
Yeah, it was incredible. Also interesting to be so near and yet not really in the thick of it, but the imagery that we got. And then eventually when it was okay to drive through Xenia and to see, you know, I remember, again, you remember these very specific things. The house is gone, but there's a pipe sticking up from the ground at the second floor and a toilet left, period. So that was somebody's life, and now it's just that pile of rubble. It was a very striking thing even for a kid.
What was it like growing up here in Yellow Springs?
The first answer that comes to mind is when I was a little bit done growing up, I went off to college, and I would tell people I was from this really cool, great little town in Yellow Springs. I really value the fact that I grew up here, and I tried to communicate that to people by letting them know what a great, cool, accepting, diverse kind of town this was. And then by the same token, from a young person's perspective, it took me a while to get past that narrative to the fact that in typical adolescent fashion, it was also a kind of a boring place to grow up as well. It's, you know, the middle of Southwest Ohio. I was just doing an exercise with my writers in the workshop the other day based on an article by Mary Catherine Bateson. She's Margaret Mead's daughter. And she talks about how we all have at least two life stories. And it can be very interesting to write both of those stories and to find the continuity in them. So, for instance, I grew up in the coolest little hippie town in America, and I also grew up in the most boring place in America surrounded by cornfields and pig farms.
That's all a matter of perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great for the writer's toolbox in any case.
In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and Chris Tebbets has joined me in studio. We talked about your collaboration with James Patterson, but I don't want to neglect the fact that you've done a lot of other stuff. Let's talk about some of your other books.
As I mentioned before, I just, by whatever strange coincidence, have fallen into a lot of co-authoring. My very first books were the ones with the packager I mentioned before. That was a fantasy adventure series called The Viking, about a kid who falls back in time to 9th century Scandinavia and finds himself in the center of a mythic Viking quest. I had been trying to write picture books at the time, and when I discovered that these book packagers were a way into the business, and I gave them my name, and they just happened to be looking for a writer on this series and asked how I felt about Vikings, I told them I loved Vikings, and then I went out and learned all about Vikings and learned to love Vikings, and in fact did love writing that series. And then one of the things I tell students all the time is that it's really all about showing up. I would go to workshops and classes and try to connect with online communities and on and on and on, always thinking, gosh, I want every experience to yield me some tangible gain in my career. I want to come away from a workshop with an editor's name who's going to read my stuff. And of course, it didn't work out that way. Some of those were very frustrating experiences. But in the aggregate, what was really going on was showing up and showing up and showing up and showing up. So you could be in the one right place at the right time. And it was through that book packager that I met the editor, who then hooked me up with my next project, who then hooked me up with my next project, who introduced me to my agent. It sort of flowed from there.
I'm going to guess that discipline of showing up was something that you learned during your theatrical experiences.
That's a good question. I was a gigantic theater geek in high school, and I liked nothing more than putting on plays. But I'm not entirely sure that that's exactly accurate, because I loved doing plays, and I did spend my 20s. I lived in New York City. I did a lot of summer stock and a lot of theater, and I loved the jobs that fell in my lap, but I didn't love going and looking for those jobs. Mm-hmm. I didn't love selling myself. And so the discipline came from, I think, an even deeper appreciation for writing books, one that was deep enough that it motivated me to do the things that I might not otherwise really care to do.
What kind of stuff were you reading when you were in middle school?
I always say that we all have our own emotional bat phone back to one age or another, the age that we remember the most. And I remember those middle grade years the most. And those were Roald Dahl. Roald Dahl was the man. I read all of his stuff and reread all of his stuff, and Judy Blume and Encyclopedia Brown, which had this interactive quality. I loved being invited into the story. Maybe that ties into my love of theater and I liked being a participant in the story. James and the Giant Peach, again, Roald Dahl, an all-time favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Books about – this is another exercise we do with our writers. One thing that you can do is just on impulse, just write down the top five or top 10 books you remember taking home from the library, the ones you remember reading over and over, not the finest books, but the ones that you love the most, and start to look at themes in that list. What are the things that you see? What are the connections you see? And it's a great way to generate ideas. It's a great way to think about your core material. And when I do that, I see stories that were larger than life, just like I write today. And I see funny stories, just like I write today. So it can be an interesting loop back.
Did you hang out in the library?
I did. My mom took me to the library every week for as long as I can remember, the Yellow Springs Public Library. I always say I was creatively born in the Yellow Springs Public Library. And then appropriately enough, I got a job as a page there in high school and worked there for 3 years. So I have a great fondness for the Yellow Springs Public Library.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
The Greene County Library is one of the underwriters of this program. So we're very high on libraries here on the program. We always have been.
Well, thank you for that, too.
My guest is Chris Tebbets, and he joins us in studio, and we really wrestled with his schedule because they've been keeping him so busy teaching at the Antioch Writers Workshop this week that it's really been tough getting him to have even a little bit of free time to come over here and talk to us, but we managed to do it here as he's winding down his week at the workshop, and I have to think maybe my encounter with your mother the other day at the grocery store might have had something to do with it. Did your mother say, you know, I saw Vic again. He really wants to talk to you.
Yes, she did. I love Yellow Springs. I called my dentist once to ask a question about I don't know what, and they said, oh, your mom's here to see the eye doctor on the other half of the office. You want to say hi to her while you're here? the whole small town thing is I lived in New York City for a long time. Great experience, but I've been in Vermont for 21 years, and it's way more my speed. Yellow Springs set my DNA that way for sure.
So give us the scene. Set the scene in Vermont. Where do you live? What kind of a place is it? What's your writing setup? When do you write? Do you just burrow in? Tell us what that's like.
I used to live in Burlington, which is, you can't see me air quoting right now, but the city. And eventually we moved out to a little town, Yellow Springs-sized town called Hinesburg. And again, I air quote the country because it's a bit of a bedroom community for Burlington. But in sort of stereotypical fashion, I live on a dead-end dirt road in the woods. Once it all greens in the summer and spring, I can't see any of my neighbors, which suits me. I'm not one of those writers who does well in coffee houses and with noise. I don't listen to music when I write. So I'm definitely a solitude lover, just like I was when I was a kid. I used to, you know, love nothing more than to climb up a tree and read a book alone. Again, not all writers I know have to write every day. I do write every day. And I do best if I get up and do it first thing in the morning when my mind is fresh, with the exception of the necessary cup of coffee. When I hear a lot of interviews with writers, I say this to people all the time, and when you ask them what they attribute their success, the first word you hear most often is persistence, and second most often is coffee. So, and that's definitely true for me, including the persistence part. It really is all about persistence. I always say you need two of the three things to succeed, which is persistence, talent, and luck. You can get away, you know, with persistence and luck if you're not so talented, but if you luck out, you can sell your subpar manuscript. If you're really talented and you work really hard, you'll do great, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's great to have all three of those things. But and the other thing is, of that list, persistence, talent, and luck, the one thing you can control is the persistence, getting your so-called butt in chair time.
I see here in town, we have a coffee shop where a lot of writers are down there writing all the time, and it's a really busy, active place. And I'm always amazed when I go in there and I see that, because I'm like you. I could not focus with all the distraction, and I'm really impressed that they can do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a staple of the writing world for a lot of people. And I have been down to the Emporium to write a few times when I'm in town. I think the first time you and I met, you walked up and said, "You must be Cy Tabitz's kid." And there I was with my laptop. But as a general rule, I'm glad that worked for them, not my thing.
Mm. Yeah, I remember your dad very well. He was part of a circle of gentlemen here in town that I got to know a little bit, and kind of the village elders, I considered them.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot about this community just by being the fly on the wall when they would have their conversations.
Yeah, my dad was a great model. He sold business furniture for a living, and that's nothing I ever wanted to do. But what he modeled to me and to, I think, a lot of people is doing what you love. And I never had parents who said, "Oh, don't go into theater, don't go into writing, you'll never make a living." They made room for me to do what I love, and that's what I'm getting to do, which is awesome.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest today is Chris Tabitz. And Chris, I was looking at your book list. I went onto Amazon, which is a place I go to a lot because they have so much information about authors, and you have a little page there with your information. I assume you probably provided it, but on there you said something about how you're kind of superstitious. You're one of these writers that doesn't like to talk about the stuff that you're working on for the future. And I know a lot of writers are that way. Is that true about you?
Absolutely. I mean, I call what I have rational superstition, which is to say it's empirically borne out by the sample of my own experience that talking about ideas can really take the energy out of them. It can kill an idea. I heard an interview with an artist named Ann Hamilton, and she talks about giving your ideas away too soon and allowing yourself the space to find out what the thing is before you start naming what the thing is. There can be a lot of pressure to tell people what you're working on. If you're working on a novel for 6 months or for a year and people want to know what you're doing, it gets a little tiresome to say, "Oh, a book," and leave it at that. It can be very tempting to talk about it, but I've learned over and over that I do better not talking about things until they're a done deal.
Well, there's something magical about the process, isn't there?
There is. There's something magical about that bubble that you create around the story. And also, at least in my experience, around the momentum you create around a story, letting something go for a while and coming back to it, that can take the energy out of it for me. That's why I do write 7 days a week, not all day, but touching on my stories every day really helps.
Mm. We've had a writer on this program who's been on the show more than anybody else. He's been on the show 13 times, and he's a novelist. And I've had James Lee Burke on for his last probably 10 books in a row, and he's like that. He doesn't want to talk about what he's working on, but you know he's always working on something because he lives for that. That is his life, writing. Can you imagine a life without writing?
That is a complicated question for me, because one of the things I love about writing is it doesn't feel separate from me. It feels like a part of me. And that's a double-edged sword. I mean, we live in a world where maybe identification with our work has gone a little bit far. Work is the new religion, some people will say. We worship at the altar of our offices, all of those sorts of things. On the other hand, writing is a very personal process. And I really cherish the fact that what I do for a living comes from who I am, has something so deeply to do with who I am. So I guess the short answer is no, I can't imagine a life without writing. But ask me after I win the Powerball and see what I do with that money.
So what's a good day for you when you're writing? Do you have a quota? Do you have a desire to hit a certain number of words or paragraphs? Or is there something that you're shooting for as a goal to say, okay, I can go relax?
This gets filed under the kind of advice I give and don't follow. A lot of writers I know say, look, I'm going to do 2,000 words a day. I'm going to do 4 chapters this week. If I have any kind of rubric, it's about time, because sometimes, this is another thing I talk to young writers about. It's a job, and there are days when it's a real slog. And so I try to show up as early as possible. And if I'm really not feeling like being there, I'll give myself an amount of time. But in terms of those goals for the day, those words, those chapters, just not my thing.
Well, I have to think that as a motivating factor, if you just happen to be working on a project that's a collaboration with James Patterson, that you probably have a lot of enthusiasm for your work.
I would say that's definitely true. What I guess I left out of my last answer is I'm highly motivated by deadlines. I'm trying to think if there's a project I've done that has not had a deadline attached. In fact, the novel that we just sold this spring, the YA I'm working on right now, the original idea with my agent was to finish it and then try and sell it. And it just wasn't getting finished. So we went to plan B and sold it on a partial. And I now have a deadline, which is going to hopefully force my hand to finishing that thing.
I am very fond of deadlines. They make me do things. And without them, without that structure, I have deadlines, multiple deadlines every week, which I meet. And without them, I don't think I'd get anything done.
It's true for me. I used to resist that fact. And then I thought, why am I resisting that fact? Why not understand and accept my own process? It's something I recommend to everybody to figure out their own process and go from there. There's a book called Deep Work that identifies different categories of the way people do their best, deepest work. Some of them, like journalists is one example, do great with outlines. Not everybody does, but I found it really useful to look at those categories and see where I slot in. And I think a big part of it for me over the years has been exactly that, getting to know what my process is, what kind of writer I am, not what kind of writer I wish I were. I watched way too much TV as a kid. I say this all the time. I used to resist that. I wanted to be Edith Wharton. I'm not Edith Wharton, and I'm never going to be. But I can write the books that I can write, and why not spend my time and energy on that?
Chris, it's been lovely to have you on the program.
It's been great. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Chris Tebbets. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.